sponsor. There's more, so don't hesitate. It's a good night in class, huh? Yeah. A little roast beef, a little chocolate. It's not so bad, Kanahara. Could be worse. Could be worse. All right, well, we've gone through the theories of nationalism, and we talked about Hobsbawm, and we talked about the Jews, a nation, or a people, or a state, or whatever you want to call them, and we saw where they fit into so many different categories. Now we're going to do some practical stuff. We're going to talk about Napoleon, before that the French Revolution, and we're going to talk about how Jewish nationalism itself comes to be questioned and is changing. We're going to talk about the Enlightenment. We might touch a little on Moses Mendelssohn, one of the key figures of that. And that's all in the lead-up to the founding of modern Zionism. Well, the precursors, really, to Zionism, and then the founding of modern Zionism. And then from then on, we're really just going to be digging into Zionism and taking a look at what's initially understood and exposing whether or not it's a myth or not and what have you. But first, we're going to start with the French Revolution. Right? The American Revolution, of course, began democracy and freedom and all that, but it really didn't have a great impact on the European continent, at least not right away. The French Revolution, of course, came in 1789 with its famous cry of liberty, eternity, and equality and fraternity. Not eternity. Equality and fraternity. So famous, huh? It was about liberalism. It was about the self-determination of a people. And it's interesting, and Hobsbawm points it out in his book, about 50% of the people in France had French as their first language. Right? You know, of course, later on in the book, he famously talks about Italy. He says something like, until the 1960s, I don't know what he said, 20% or 30% of the Italians didn't have Italian as a first language, and it really took TV and all this other stuff in terms of the modern world to bring it together. French Revolution also brought us Napoleon, who was kind of a liberal dictator in many regards, who would have dramatic impact on Jewish nationalism. He freed people by bashing empires, right? He made a mistake by invading Russia, for sure, as others would do later, but he would free the Italians, he would parts of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and what have you. At the same time, the Enlightenment is taking place. The Enlightenment is an openness to new ideas and expressions and theologies and philosophies and what have you, and a loosening of the old strictures on the state. The kings wouldn't have as much power as they used to have. The noblemen wouldn't have as much power as they used to have. New governments were coming into being. By 1825, we had a revolution in Greece, so that had left the Ottoman Empire. So peoples were beginning to free themselves. Hegel, by the way, was the key exponent of the nation-state idea. Now, Hegel is a very famous philosopher, famous name, and this is what he had to say about the state. And it's quite interesting. I'm going to show you why in a second. The state in and by itself is the ethical whole, the actualization of freedom, and it is an absolute end of reason that freedom should be actual. The march of God in the world, that is what the state is. The basis of the state is the power of reason actualizing itself as will. This is very interesting. Hegel is bridging two worlds. He's bridging the world where God is at the center, and he's bridging the world, the emerging world, where the people are basically the rulers. The government is going to become the expression of the peoples. But just like the rest of the world until then, God is still at the center for Hegel, although definitions of God and as a deity and you know people's responsibility to God are beginning to change, as we see reflected in the reform movement of Judaism, which is beginning to take off around this time too. This is the first half of the 19th century. About the same time that Hegel was making himself famous, or making his fame, the French Revolution was settling in. So a lot is going on at this time. French Revolution, of course, is just confined to France at first. It's really Napoleon that's going to push its parameters across the continent. And Napoleon ruled from 1801 to 1815, so it wasn't a short period of time, and he was head of the armies before that for a few years as well. So the modern era has already begun in Europe. The French did this, by the way, with the Declaration of the Rights of the Man and Citizen. It guaranteed freedom of religion, and it provided that it did not contradict public order. France has always had this mixed view in some regards of what freedoms are, right? And that's still going on today in France. It's a free country, but you can't wear a headscarf if you're a Muslim woman, right? At least in the school system. Interesting is to have that, see that debate continue to go on since the French Revolution. Did they ask the Jews not to wear kippahs or recommend it that they wear baseball hats? Yeah, it is. It is. It's entirely for safety.
But what does that say about
right?
Well, that's right. Suppose you wear the wrong baseball cap.
Right. But that now that's in this country.
Like a Yankee hat.
Right. You wear a Yankees hat in Baltimore, you're in trouble. French Revolution was very interesting, and Arthur Herzberg actually is the pioneer, or not a pioneer, but a critical scholar in the French Revolution as well. He wrote a book called The Jews of France, and he delves into the French Revolution. In 1790, the Sephardi Jews, who were primarily in southern France, were given their citizenship. It took a whole year of debating in the French Parliament before the Ashkenazi Jews would be given their freedom as well, 1791. The Ashkenazi Jews were seen as outsiders. So the Sephardi were seen as, they spoke more French, they were more rooted in the business community, and what have you. Napoleon comes along, like I said, and he's a fascinating figure in his own right, because he does something for the Jews that no one has ever done. He gives them the promise of freedom, and then he actually gives it to them. This is a little interesting tidbit I wanted to pull for you guys. In 1799, Napoleon's army is off the shore of Akko in Israel. He's fighting the combination of the British troops and the Turkish troops. There were different alliances at different times. And Napoleon sends a letter to the Jews, so to speak, you know, a general letter, and a French newspaper reported it, said, he's published a proclamation in which he invites all Jews of Asia and Africa to gather under his flag and to reestablish the ancient Jerusalem. He has already given arms to a great number, and their battalions threaten Aleppo. That wasn't true, but it is true that Napoleon had issued a proclamation of freedom to the Jews and asked, and in the Holy Land, and asked them to fight under his banner. It's been said that this was done to woo the ruler of Akko, who was Jewish, for the Ottomans, Chaim Farhi. I'm sorry, he was an advisor to the Turkish ruler of Akko, who didn't bite whatsoever. Napoleon, nonetheless, continued woo the Jews in many regards. I wish I could get that down. 1800, he said, if I governed a nation of Jews, I should reestablish the Temple of Solomon. So he's doing everything he can to woo the Jews. In part, this might be because he wants to mainstream them. He sees this as a continuation of the French Revolution. Throughout, he continued to do these things, and finally his physician asked him, when he was under arrest on the island of Elba in 1816, my primary desire was to liberate the Jews and make them full citizens. I wanted to confer upon them all the legal rights of equality, liberty, and fraternity, as was enjoyed by the Catholics and Protestants. It is my wish that Jews be treated like brothers, as if we were all part of Judaism. As an added benefit, I thought this would bring France to many riches, because the Jews are numerous and they would come in large numbers to our country, where they would enjoy more privileges than any other nation. Without the events of 1814, when he began to have some reverses on the battlefield, most of the Jews of Europe would have come to France, where equality, fraternity, and liberty awaited them, and where they can serve the country like everyone else. Napoleon is, of course, continuing this, I'll say, kind of benign anti-Semitism. He wants the Jews to come in to bring all their money and their wealth, and they're really going to benefit him. So there's a couple other quotes on Napoleon as well, but what I want to go to is his Assembly of Jewish Notables. The issue of Jews and their loyalty to the state continued in France. So Napoleon called together an Assembly of Jewish Notables, and he gave them 12 questions to consider. And these are important questions because some of them become the ones that the Zionists have to consider as well. Is it legal for Jews to have more than one wife? Yeah, actually, it's not legal. Since the 10th century, a guy named Rabbeinu Gershom outlawed that. Is divorce allowed by the Jewish religion? May a Jew marry a Christian, or may a Christian may a Jewish marry a Christian, or may a Jew marry a Christian woman? In the eyes of Jews, are Frenchmen not of the Jewish religion considered as brethren or as strangers? This was going to be a key question. What conduct does Jewish law prescribe toward Frenchmen not of the Jewish religion? Do the Jews born in France and treated by law as French citizens acknowledge France as their country? This is going to be something that the Zionists are going to reject. They say, no, this is no longer our country. We need to go to Palestine or the land of Israel. Are they bound to defend it? And so on. What we talked about before in terms of nationalism. I love that one. Who elects the rabbis? They elect themselves. Right? David, is that true? Well, who conferred smicha on you?
I couldn't say in Mexico.
Hey, I was going to say, you know, rabbis confer on rabbis. What kind of police do the jurisdiction do the rabbis exercise over the Jews? These days we would say very little. Are the police jurisdiction of the rabbis in the forms of the election regulated by Jewish law or only sanctioned by custom? Are there professions from which the Jews are excluded by law? Does Jewish law forbid the Jews to taking interest from their brethren? And does it forbid or does it allow usury in dealings with strangers? These were questions that went to the heart of the matter as to whether or not Jews could be normal, quote-unquote, citizens in Europe. These were the questions that the French Revolution forced on Jews and their rabbis. And it wasn't something that the Jews, I assure you, that some of the rabbis would have looked at initially. This was the assembly of Jewish notables. When Napoleon got all the answers that he wanted, and he did get all the answers that he wanted, because you better believe the rabbis knew exactly what to say to him, because what were you going to say to Napoleon? Napoleon had them convene a grand Sanhedrin. Anybody, we talked about in one of the earlier classes. What's the Sanhedrin? It's the ancient Jewish court. There's 71 notables on that court. By the way, here's a lithograph or an etching, I'm not sure what it is, that I found, of the assembly of Jewish notables. This was not an insignificant little event. This had been given great significance by Napoleon and by others. And as you can see, they were given quite a nice haul. So now this is a little harder to see. The Grand Sanhedrin gathered 71 rabbis and leaders of the community, just like the ancient one. Two-thirds of them were rabbis. About a third of them were laymen. Their job was to put the religious imprimatur on the answers to these questions. Their job was to say, yeah, we believe that what they said was absolutely right. Again, it was called relatively quickly afterwards. This is how they did it. They had a solemn service in a synagogue. They assembled in a nearby hotel. They sat in a semicircle, like in the Sanhedrin of old. Laymen sat behind the rabbis. Rabbis were attired in black and silk capes and three-cornered hats. Jews from various countries came and addressed them. And then they convened. Then they quickly said, we agree to everything, and they dismissed themselves. And some of what they agreed to. Divorce by the Jewish law is valid only after previous decision of civil authorities. Meaning that the Jews are not a separate nation. Right? This is where Jewish religion becomes separated from the nation. Religious act of marriage must be preceded by civil contract. Same thing. Marriages between Jews and Christians are binding but cannot be celebrated with religious forms. That's kind of interesting. Israelite is required to consider the land of his birth or adoption as his fatherland and shall love and defend it when called upon. So the Jews are part and parcel, part of the state, and they will make that ultimate sacrifice of serving in the armed forces. And Israelites are forbidden to exact usury or to lend money, to take interest, I'm sorry, from Jew or Christian. So this is where the Jews, and Europe in particular, face the issue of nationalism in a very specific way, a very succinct way. And Michelle, I can email this to you if you want to put it up on the things. So if you're, I see some of you are taking notes, so don't worry, we're able to access it. For Jews, this idea of integration into the European countries was embodied by Moses Mendelssohn. Anyone ever heard of Mendelssohn? What do you know about him? Absolutely. Grandson. This is his grandson, who's the composer. He lived his life as an Orthodox Jew. He shared some of the ideology of Reform Judaism, but he was not a Reform Jew by any stretch. But some of what he did laid the groundwork for Reform Judaism. He comes a little before Reform Judaism begins taking off. He wrote a book called Jerusalem. He wrote where he talks about Judaism being a revealed legislation, not a divine legislation.
What I've read, he's considered to be the first to really break out and socialize on Jews and
right. He's the father of the Jewish Enlightenment, right? He's which is known as Haskalah, Haskalah, and he's a Maskil, and we'll get to that a little later. Maskil. But he's really the father of all that. And let me give you some background information on him. He had a hunchback. He wasn't a particularly lovely person to look at. He was known as the Hunchback of Dessau by his critics. He lived in 1726 to 1789. He grew up poor. He had a very traditional education. He was intrigued by Moses Maimonides, or the Rambam, who, by the way, was the great rationalist, which influenced him greatly. He taught himself German through his thought and literature. Of course, Yiddish would have been the first language. He was a philosopher. He had works such as The Treatise on Evidence in the Metaphysical Sciences. Yeah, I'm not going to read that one. I think I'm just going to skip that one. What he really did better than anyone else is he represented Jews to non-Jews. He did this famously through his friendship with playwrights of the day and other intellectuals of the day. And what his goal was to show the non-Jew that I'm just like you, and I also happen to be smart. I can interact with the best of them. There's nothing wrong with my people as long as you give us a chance. He was a little early on all this, but he laid the groundwork. He said Judaism was non-dogmatic. It was a rational faith. It was open to modernity and to change. He called for secular education. He taught himself Hebrew and a whole bunch of other languages. I'll give you one example of his interactions with non-Jews. He was very friendly with Immanuel Kant, the great philosopher of the era. And he beat Kant for a prize in 1763. That the Berlin Academy gave out, which was very prestigious. It was for an essay called On Evidence in the Metaphysical Sciences. That year, the king granted him, not his wife and children, but him, the status of a protected Jew, meaning that he couldn't be kicked out of Berlin. You still needed permission at that time, if you were a Jew, to live in Berlin. There were cities in Europe where you had to leave out of the city's gates. Remember, many cities were still walled by nightfall. If you were you, you couldn't be caught, or you take the risk of being caught. He was known as the German Plato in some regards, and he was very well known in his day. Jewishly, one of the greatest things that he wanted to do was bring the Jews to modern Jewish, modern German culture and civilization. In 1783. He translated the Torah into German using Hebrew letters, right? Jews couldn't read German, but they could read Hebrew. So this was his tool for doing that. It was called the Biur, or the explanation. Mendelssohn, by the way, would go on to say that Yiddish was, quote, ridiculous, ungrammatical, and a cause of moral corruption. But he really saw, he was a Hochjew, he was a high Jew, he believed in Hochdeutsch and high German. He would found the first modern Jewish day school, and that would be in Berlin in 1778. In 1783, he published the book Jerusalem, or On Religious Power and Judaism. He said that a state has no right to interfere with the religion of its citizens, Jews included. He proclaims the mandatory character of Jewish law for all Jews, but says that the rabbis don't have the right to punish individual Jews for breaking the law. So bucking the rabbinical trend as well. And he said that there could be a plurality of truths. So Judaism no longer held the answer. It was an answer. This was one of the important... I'm telling you all this because he was really the father of ushering in Jews as choosing whether or not to be part of the nation state or the state in Europe in the 19th century. His legacy... He really opened Jews to the non-Jewish world and the non-Jewish world to Judaism. The non-Jewish world had no interaction with Judaism. All it saw were the poor shtetl Jews prior to this. the sad part of his legacy was that he had 6 children and 4 of them converted to Christianity. And his grandson, Felix Mendelssohn, the composer, converted to Christianity as well. And that's what you were mentioning very famously. He was a maskil, M-A-S-K-I-L. The goals of the maskilim were to remove the Talmud from the central position in Jewish life. Jewish life had been ruled by the Talmud. And this was something that, by the way, that many of our early Zionists are going to break from this. They came from religious homes in Eastern Europe. This is all taking place in Central Europe. Central Europe, the Enlightenment takes place much earlier. It starts creeping its way eastward. Napoleon, by the way, brought parts of it in that direction, but it didn't hold, or at least the ideas. Maskilim preached loyalty to the state, right? They preached patriotism. Zionism wasn't an option at that time. It taught that girls could be educated. At the time, girls had primarily been educated, if at all, by tutors in homes. And that was primarily the wealthy families. In the 1790s and up forward, the Maskilim would establish schools for girls in Central Europe, which would be something new. But the curriculum in general for the girls always included Hebrew and German and the fundamentals of religion and ethics and prayers and arithmetic. With the Maskilim, you needed to start teaching the teachers with these new schools, right? And they needed to train teachers for the schools, so seminaries would open in Amsterdam and Budapest and elsewhere. New rabbinical seminaries were opening, too, in places called Zhytomyr and I think Vilna or Vilnius. These were often government-controlled or run institutions. So they, too, were going to put a different stamp of nationalism beyond what was the traditional approach of Jewish nationalism. It was now loyalty to the states. Maskilim emerged from these seminaries, and they did something very interesting. They began a decline for Yiddish, primarily in Central Europe, but also a revival of Hebrew. A Hebrew newspaper or journal called Hamaasif began in this era, really in the late 1840s, 1850s. It taught things such as science and it prepared Jews for entry into the Jewish community. So what we're starting to see is with a diminishing of Yiddish, we're seeing a rise in some small circles of Hebrew. It's not yet the modern Hebrew that Eliezer ben Yehuda is going to help really recreate. He didn't create modern Hebrew, he recreated Hebrew. With more Hebrew novels, more Hebrew readers, by the way, Hebrew novels were soon to follow. This is throughout the 1800s. And what we're going to see is these Hebrew novels are often based in Palestine, but they're based in the biblical era, and they're very romantic stories. So there's nothing yet that's challenging people, as we're going to start to see with our precursors to Zionism. Well, anyone want to guess how the Orthodox community responded to this? Not happy.
Hell no.
Hell no, but not quite in that terminology. That is, of course, right. Not well. This challenged the authority of the rabbis, as the French Revolution had already done, and they didn't want to lose even. However, there was the beginning of something called modern Orthodoxy, which is going to play a role in modern Zionism as well. Modern Orthodoxy starts founding schools and teaching a little bit of Hebrew. This is in the German-speaking lands. We're going to see this from Rabbi Simson Raphael Hirsch in the mid to late 1800s. In Russia, even some followers of the Vilna Gaon, who had died about 100 years earlier but still has influence today, became Maskilim because he had a rational approach to text study, and they were attracted to this as well. Now, the Orthodox reform, quote-unquote, would, of course, never go as long as or as far as the reform movement itself. And the reform movement itself would be one that is going to be in direct opposition to the Zionist movement. This happened in the early 1800s in Central Europe. Herzl later, by the way, would be part of what would, for lack of better terminology, be an assimilated reform group. There were two main things that they did. They said you need to view Judaism through the eyes of scientific study. It's called Wissenschaft in German. You need to make Judaism like European Protestantism, particularly in the German-speaking land. Right, so some decorum comes into play. Rabbis start giving sermons in Yiddish, which some of them weren't even giving sermons. They were giving Dvar Torahs before, so they're speaking about the issues of the day. I want to be very important. I always point this out in lectures. The early reformers absolutely believed that this would save Judaism. Absolutely believed that as the world was opening up to Jews, it needed to be a Judaism that could stand on the continent just like Protestantism or something else, because that the old reform, or old Orthodox Judaism wasn't going to work. The people walk away from that. And they took this very seriously. Men and women sat together. It's everything that we have today. Men weren't wearing kippot anymore. You know, by the way, until the 1960s at Baltimore Hebrew Congregation, you didn't wear a kippah. 70s? Okay. So, did you grow up there?
No.
Are you really into the 80s, that late?
Jersey.
I don't know about Jersey. I had a different different experience once. I went to an Orthodox synagogue in Washington, D.C., and I wore tallit, and I wasn't married, and they asked me to take it off. So I learned that custom, too. These German-speaking lands, not just Germany, but German-speaking lands. Central Europe. Think of Austria, Northern Italy, what's Poland now, a lot of places like that. Probably Denmark, all those types of places, although that wasn't necessarily German-speaking. Haskalah ended in a very interesting way. It ended in the 1870s and 1880s just as Zionism came in. Large numbers of Jews had assimilated by then. Some had immigrated to America, a few had gone to Palestine. In Russia, anti-Semitism was coming to the fore, which we saw to a great extent in 1881 with the assassination of the Tsar and some pogroms that followed that. The Maskilim began joining revolutionary movements. Right? Some of them would later go on to join Zionism as well, but they were more attracted to that. What Haskalah did, however, was it provided a roadmap into the non-Jewish society, just the way Mendelssohn had done for individuals. Haskalah did it to a much greater extent, and the Maskilim were its leader. It created modern Hebrew literature, right? It also created secular theater, a Jewish press in Hebrew, some in Yiddish and even Russian. It brought a transition of Jews from commercial jobs to labor, specifically agriculture. There are periodic attempts in Europe in the 1800s, late 1700s and 1800s, to have Jews work the land. They think that will make them, quote-unquote, useful, get them out of their little shopkeeper's modes. And it began a system of secular and Judaic education in special Jewish schools. Now, I have time to finish this last 10 minutes to go. How are we doing? All right. Okay, great. Take a drink real quickly. Woven throughout this whole experience for the Jews, for the non-Jews, is the Jewish question. Spoken about the Jewish question a little bit, but I want to spend a few minutes on it. Well, because the Jewish question is an underlying one when we speak about Zionism as well. It was a debate of non-Jews, particularly in progressive circles. Some anti-Semites thought about the Jewish question too, but they didn't think about it in the same way. There was, part and parcel, an earnest effort by some non-Jews to figure out how to make the Jews... Now keep in mind that there were a whole heck of a lot of Jews in certain parts of Europe in this time. Right? You're talking millions and millions of people. Right? In Russia by 1900, by 1880, 1890, you probably have 3 million Jews. If you include Poland, and it includes the Ukraine too, which Ukraine was included in Russia at that time. I spoke about the negative. Keep in mind that the Nazis spoke about the Jewish question as well. So this is not something new. It particularly picked up steam in Western and Central Europe. This is where it was debated to a much greater extent. It had legal and economic consequences, of course. The term, the Jewish question, was first used in Great Britain way back in 1750. It was a neutral expression then, where Jews fit. Where did Jews fit in the continent of nationalities? The Jews are an aberration, right? They don't have a land. Only the Jews, by the way, are later going to come up and say, make this our home. You know, a guy named Simon Dubnov, territorialism. He's going to say, this is where we want it to be our home. This resulted in hundreds of tractates and pamphlets and books and novels and later newspaper articles. Periodically, this would be debated by the elite of Europe. I'm going to give you just a couple of the responses to show you how diverse they were. They all formed the backdrop to which Zionism would gain its great appeal. A guy named Bruno Bayer, B-A-E-R, He wrote a book called The Jewish Question in 1843. He argued Jews can achieve political emancipation only by giving up their religious consciousness. Okay? Give up your religion. Give up your religion. Just be a normal people, quote unquote. Because, he said, political emancipation requires a secular state. Called, by the way, for the abolition of religion in general. So it wasn't just the Jews, but this was his book on the Jews. Then another guy who I'm sure you've heard of, his name was Karl Marx. By the way, everybody knows what religion Karl Marx started out as, right? Jew, and when he was 8 years old, he was baptized with the rest of his family. But he didn't stick with that too much either. He replied to Baer in 1844 with an essay the next year. His essay was called On the Jewish Question. He said it wasn't Judaism preventing Jewish assimilation, but Jews' social and economic patterns. He said they were obsessed with capitalism. It all goes back to capitalism for Karl Marx. But he said, basically, it's their pattern of how they interact and live their lives. It's not Jews per se. And then there was another guy named Werner, W-E-R-N-E-R, Sombart, S-O-M-B-A-R-T, and again, I'm going to send this all out on the website. He praised Jews for their capitalism and said they were good for society. He had a little bit of everything when it came to Jews and the Jewish question. Of course, how this was handled by different countries depended on what time it was. There were, through the Middle Ages, there were periods in England and Germany and elsewhere where Jews were excommunicated. Right? That's how you dealt with the nation of the Jews. And there was no distinguishing between good Jew and bad Jew. Jew who wants to integrate and Jew who doesn't want to integrate. Yep?
Well, not part of the debate on nationalism. It goes back to Catholic struggle with...
Right, but it becomes part of the debate on nationalism. It's not a new question, but it becomes part of the debate on nationalism because the Jews are seen as a nation.
Right, but all against the backdrop of these Catholic, actions about...
Right, so it's a modern morphing of the question in some regards, but it has deep roots, is what you're saying. Well, can't be more than 2,000, right? Right. All right. Why was all this happening? It was happening because the age of religion was beginning. Doesn't mean it wasn't going to be a powerful force. But we saw religion in terms of its hold on society, its hold on the leaders of countries, its hold on the leaders of communities, was beginning to wane. That's why variations such as Reform Judaism would begin to spring up. This was happening, obviously, in Christian countries, in Christian cultures as well, Christian communities as well. Nothing that happens to the Jewish people is not happening to greater society. Right? That's the essence of this course. Is that Zionism is part of the nationalism. It's a different type of it, but it's part of the nationalism that was taken. So, tonight, we covered nationalism and Hobsbawm, talked about the French Revolution, talked about Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment, and Mendelssohn, and the Jewish question. Guess what? Next week, we're going to start talking about the precursors to Zionism. So we're like almost there, but these are guys who have become important, not in their lifetime, but they've become of note, I should say, a little later on. Any questions on anything for tonight? Okay, thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
You're welcome.